Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 133, Eek! A Leech! This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. Well, hello! I love the title of this episode. For those of you who don't know, an old-fashioned way to refer to a doctor was to call them a leech. Which should give you a really kind of disgusting image in your mind. If you remember the movie Stand By Me, there was a scene in a swamp with some leeches. I'm just saying. So today we talk about Chillingworth when we get to our book. But first, we have all sorts of cool things to do. Last week, being overwhelmed as I was with being back and having been gone for so long, I had all sorts of things I wanted to tell you about and completely ran out of time and decided to just put all of the crafty talk, what with it being called Craftlit and all, into this week's episode. So, a few things. First, thank you to all of you, all the many, many, many all of you, who have written to me about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies by Jane Austen and Seth Graham Smith. It is actually a New York Times bestseller. It has one of the most revolting covers I have ever seen on any book, ever. Just to read you the beginning of the back, in case you haven't read this before. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a zombie in possession of brains must be in want of more brains. And thus began the tale. I have no idea if Mr. Seth Graham Smith can sustain this level of merriment. I know that things like Lord of the Rings kind of ran out of steam eventually, and many satiric turns on classic fiction often do, but if the cover's any indication, it should be a rollicking good time. I look forward to reading that. My husband actually got it for me for my birthday. I think the trip to Los Angeles for dinner at the Inn at the Seventh Ray and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies were my birthday from him. And I didn't tell you before, if you've never been to the Inn of the Seventh Ray, if you find yourself in Los Angeles, drive up the Pacific Coast Highway from Santa Monica, only 4 or 5 miles, it's really not very far, to Topanga Canyon Road. It is a light, you make a right-hand turn, because you're going north. If you make a left, you wind up in either a fish house or the ocean. I can't remember which. You head up Topanga Canyon Road quite a ways, and eventually it gets very wooded, and it smells very good, and it actually smells like you're not even remotely in a city at all, because you're not. You're in Old Topanga Canyon. Topanga Canyon Road and Old Topanga Canyon Road break off from each other before you hit Mulholland. Take the left. There's a little tiny left-hand turn outlet. You turn left up Old Topanga Canyon Road, and lo and behold, immediately upon your right, you will see the Inn of the Seventh Ray. This is an excellent restaurant. And they have since I was there last, they have changed their menu, which is kind of a shame because the old menu was explicitly ranked by the food's vibrational level. This means that meat, even if it was free range, found itself very far down the list. And vegan, organic food was listed at the highest level of the menu. And of course, this all corresponded to chakras and to the colors that are associated with chakras. And it was just great. Now, all of this would be moot if it weren't that the food was so bloody good. And the food is spectacular. So you're there, and you find yourself sitting under trees, old, you know, oaks and cottonwoods and things like that, in Topanga Canyon, on a ravine with a little creek running back there. a creek which is populated by bullfrogs. And let's see, the first time I went, which was, oh dear Lord, it was in 1987. The first time I went, we were visited by coyotes. Actual, honest to goodness, not audio animatronic, real coyotes that walked up and begged for food. And what with it being a wild animal and me not having, say, fangs or claws, I fed it. I didn't see the coyotes on this trip. It's, you know, they're 22 years gone, so I don't know if they even still stay in that general area. It's much more populated than it used to be. But the bullfrogs are still there. The lights are lit. There are twinkly little white lights in the trees, those little tiny Christmas lights. And it's about as romantic as you can get without, oh, I don't know, sitting there with Colin Firth. It was lovely. So we did that. And of course, what did I do in the car on the way up there? I knitted, because usually in Tucson, I drive. It's my hometown, and I know my way around even now a little bit better than my husband does, and I have a pretty good sense of direction. So I tend to be the one who's driving. Well, this time, he knew where we were going. I decided to be navigator. He drove, and I knit socks. I am knitting a dumpster load of little socklets for the Sock Summit for my classes that I'm going to be teaching up there. And if you are taking said class, Betty in Hawaii and I have been corresponding. If you're using DK weight yarn, figure about 120-ish yards. If you're going to turn the little socklet into an actual pedicure sock, and somewhere around 200 or so yards if you're using worsted. I'm going with scrap yarn. All of the socklets that I have made thus far have been made with scrap yarn left over from previous socks. So don't sweat it. And I'm also going to bring extra sock yarn in case anyone gets stuck at the last minute. So if you're in my class, don't sweat the details. Just get those little anklets started so we can fly through a bunch of different sock heels. So what does that mean? It means that my fingers are sore, is what it means. It also means that I am a complete and utter fool, because my sister is getting married this December here in Tucson to a lovely man from Berlin, who we all love, and she asked for a shawl, and I said, sure. So I am knitting out of the Knitted Lace of Estonia book by Nancy Bush. Nancy Bush, who is also teaching at Sock Summit, who I imagine I'll probably at some point fall on my face groveling like a complete idiot in front of her, telling her how spectacular I think she is. But you know, if I could speak to Robin Williams 20 years ago, maybe there's a chance that I could speak to Nancy Bush. Of course, it took me hours before I could speak to Robin Williams looking him in the face, which is still kind of embarrassing, but it would happen to just about anyone, right? If you were put in a room alone with Robin Williams, and everybody behind you, the directors and writers and technicians and everybody, were sitting behind you, behind a big glass window, and you were, oh, I don't know, 24, wouldn't you be nervous and have a hard time looking him in the eye and speaking to him? I did. Maybe I'll be better with Nancy. Anyway, my sister chose from the Knitted Lace of Estonia book the Lilac Leaf Shawl on page 97. I was relieved to find that she chose this shawl, because number one, it is rectangular, which, you know, minimizes the number of complete and disastrous mess-ups you can make. It also makes it quite easy to do lifelines, because you have a regular width that you're dealing with, instead of having to use ever-increasing pieces of dental floss. And for those of you who haven't done it before, a lifeline would be a thread or a smaller piece of yarn that you put on a needle, and you run it through all of the stitches in a row, so that if, God forbid, something should happen and you have to frog back, you can just rip that sucker out with complete impunity, because the yarn will stop unraveling when it hits that horizontal piece of thread or yarn or whatever you used. I use unwaxed dental floss. It goes through very quickly and very easily. It's unobtrusive, and it doesn't completely destroy the aesthetic of looking at the piece while you're working on it. So, dental floss, I'm all over it. But I was so relieved to see that she chose a very simple and straightforward rectangular shawl. It still has the knitted on edging, which I'm still a little concerned about. I have to graft it on. But, you know, I have a friend who's an expert grafter, my friend Jill, who lives here and is part of their fabulous guild. And so I think I will be talking to Jill. But the other thing that I really kind of like about it is I've gotten, I'm looking at the chart. I'm 17, 18. I'm 19 rows in, which I know doesn't sound like much, but for those of you who've knitted lace before, I'm 19 rows in. I'm 19 rows in, and the nice thing is you can really see the pattern already. Sometimes lace just looks like a big blob of goo while you're working on it. This, not so much. I am using that lovely cashmere silk blend that I've used before. It's, I think it's Filatura de Crossi. It's beautiful. I'm very happy with it, with the hand and the drape. And I think it'll be quite warm for my sister for an outdoor December 12th wedding this coming December, because it'll still be warm during the day in Tucson. The chances of us having a freak snowstorm in December are slim to none. So that's all very happy and good. If any of you have knitted the lilac leaf shawl and have words of warning or advice for me, please feel free to email me at heather@craftlit.com. It's new. Or you can still get me at mamaoknits@gmail.com. Although it's easier to say heather@craftlit.com, so I'm going to be switching over. But the mamaoknits will still remain my Gmail address forever. I have received, I'm so excited, my first submission for the 2009 Craftlit Challenge. It is a scarlet letter pattern. I have received it from Cheryl. Cheryl, it's gorgeous. Thank you so much. And I can't remember. I have to go back and read the directions. I can't remember if we said we were going to post pictures of the submissions as they came in or wait and surprise you all at the end. I have to think about this for a minute. Because I don't, you know, you don't want to sway anyone, but you also don't want to dissuade anyone from entering by saying, oh my gosh, everything is so gorgeous. But you also don't want to diss the people who've gotten stuff in early because, gosh, you kind of want some feedback right away. So for now, Cheryl, this is your feedback. This is gorgeous, and I love it. But don't let that dissuade you if you haven't already entered. You have plenty of time. We are on chapter 9 this week. We are only going to be doing chapter 9 this week. So we're not speeding through the book or anything like that. Along with doing the many, many, many socks and, or socklets, and the knitted shawl for my sister, I continue to work on another baby Bobby Bear for my friend who had twins months ago. But you know, it's not like the babies are going to want to play with a little knitted bear yet. So I don't feel so bad about not finishing the bear yet. I do, however, feel bad about not having fixed my scarlet letter logo that you see on this podcast. I've been trying, for those of you who follow this on Ravelry, I've mentioned this in a couple of different forums, but I've never actually gotten any responses from anyone, so I'm going to say it now because I'm remembering it. I have consistently now for at least a year been putting artwork in with the podcast itself, with the electronic MP3 file, and I have been putting chapter markers in with the podcast. I believe on iTunes, if you click something, you can skip to the next chapter, and I believe on newer model iPods, you can do the same thing. What that will do for you is it will skip you ahead through all the crafty talk and me yammering to where I start to teach the next chapter of the book. So, if you are in the mood for not me, but me book, the chapter marker should let you skip through it rather than having to fast forward, which I personally find laborious and difficult when I want to skip ahead on a podcast. Because it happens, you know? So, if this works for you, let me know, and let me know what you're using it on. Like, are you using the chapter marker thing on iTunes itself, or on Windows Media Player, or on an iPod? And if so, what kind of iPod? If it's not working for you, also let me know the same information, and I'll be able to figure out if there's some way I can kind of jerry-rig the whole thing and get that fixed, because I think it would be useful for everyone. And jerry-rigged. Okay, here's a question for you. I thought all this time it was jerry-rigged, like when you jerry-rig something, Jerry being Jerry like Germans in World War II, and World War II being, I don't know, a war where people had to come up with different ways in the field to, I don't know, make a Jeep go. You know, so my grandfather, who built a car when he was 11, and the one that he built when he was 12 is still on the road, I've mentioned him before. He was MacGyver. He was the guy who you could go to and say, my car isn't running, and he'd say, oh, hang on, and he'd go get a hanger from inside the house, and he'd twist it, and he'd put it inside your engine, and your car would run again. To me, that was jerry-rigging the car. I had always assumed it was just from World War II. It's not. Oxford English Dictionary said jury-rigged, J-U-R-Y. Is what I say. I'm shocked. The things you learn. Of course, I don't know if that was the most recent OED. Now I'm thinking, I should go back and check that again. I'm also going to be, before we get into the book today, I am going to be filling you in on a rather wonderful email conversation I had with one of our listeners who happens to be a Presbyterian pastor. Her name is Renee. She's in California, Northern California. Lucky thing. And we had a really, really interesting back and forth about predestination and Puritans and all that kind of stuff. And I've been kind of using some of what she said as I've been talking about the book. But since this next chapter that we're going to go into deals with Chillingworth specifically, but also a lot more kind of Satan imagery and discussion, I thought it would probably be good for us to revisit some stuff about the Puritans themselves. So, going back in time a bit, we had talked about the Puritans and the whole theory of the elect, that only the elect are people who are going to go to heaven. So Renee said, and I love that she started this way, good try on explaining the elect, predestination, and Calvin. Because, you know, I'm not ordained, and she is, and she was probably just cracking herself up every once in a while during that long Puritan podcast. But she goes on to say, you're right that Calvin says that we cannot know who the elect are, because there was this emphasis on God's all-knowing nature, predestination, and that without God's action first, we humans would never even think about drawing ourselves toward and asking to be saved. But we have to also make the effort to ask to be saved. And then she said various theologies and denominations emphasize different parts of those two points. She said, it made people anxious not to know whether they were saved or not. So, pastorally, I was correct. The idea came about that works would be a sign that you were already a part of the elect, not as a way to earn your place, and that that would be a way that you could then relax, that if you were drawn toward being a good person and doing good things, that would be a sign that you were already in. So being part of the elect meant that you had experienced God's grace, asked to be saved, so that in return, in gratitude, one would do good in the world in response to God's great love. So all the do-gooding was at best a sign of real gratitude and desire to bring in God's kingdom, and of course making sure that your neighbors thought that you were one of the elect. She said it was the if you quack like a duck kind of thinking. So that's pretty good. But she goes on and says a variant understanding of Presbyterian predestination was double predestination. God determines who will go to heaven and to hell. Simple predestination only worries about heaven. So one question about Hester is this. Did God determine that she was a reprobate and consign her to hell, or did she freely choose by her major sin not to go to heaven? Of course, Hester's response in today's chapter, which was back three chapters when she was talking to Chillingworth, would actually have been the reverse. She was doing all this good, so of course she would be going to heaven. Renee also goes on to say, which, you know, honestly, I thought it meant that my youth minister hundreds of years ago was different. But in fact, she says, regarding scholarship, Presbyterian pastors are still required to this day to be able to translate Hebrew and Greek, to be able to go back to the original languages. And Anne Hutchins' offense was not that she taught the Bible, but that, gasp everyone, put your back of your hand to your forehead and pretend that you're about to faint. Her original offense was that she taught the Bible to men. Men, those of you who are in our listenership, and I know you're out there, because you write to me, I know your names. Do you find this shocking? I really do. You know, every once in a while, my husband will come out with something. I'll be like, really? That still is like a thing? And he'll look at me and go, duh. So it's nice to be married to someone who you can have a conversation like that with. But yeah, so Anne Hutchinson blew it because she was talking to the boys is what she was doing, hanging out with the boys. And I think I already corrected the Cromwell thing, but just in case I didn't, I said something about the Protestant Reformation and Cromwell. Protestant Reformation, of course, was Luther, 15... I actually looked up the date later. Original Martin Luther. And Cromwell was with not the Protestant Reformation. He was what I think of when I think of the English kind of Reformation, lowercase l, during the Commonwealth, when Cromwell came to power after the Jacobean period, which was such a nasty time. Actually, you know what? The only reason I have any concept of what the Jacobean era was like at all was because we did the play The Changeling at UCLA, and it is a bloody horror, and I am not using the word bloody metaphorically. It is a horror. So if you want to go have fun, read The Changeling. Loads of fun. She also filled me in, Quakers do not baptize for membership, so it wouldn't have been them to do the first with African Americans, which makes me think I probably misspoke. I'd forgotten that Quakers didn't baptize, but I know that Quakers opened the first African American school in Philadelphia. I think it was the first Baptists in Virginia who actually did the first African American baptism, but now I should go back and check that again too. Anyway, that gives you a little bit more information on all of that. And as far as Satan goes, you know, Satan was an actual physical presence. I know there are some denominations nowadays who don't believe that, and there are other denominations who do continue to believe that. It certainly depends upon the faith in which you were raised, which way you're going to go on that question. But my feeling about all of the Satan questions that show up in literature, my feeling goes like this. If you go back and you look at the book Huckleberry Finn, I always do this to you, don't I? Where I start to answer a question and then I use a piece of literature to explain it. Well, I'm going to do it again. If you go back and you look at the book Huckleberry Finn, there's a very important moment, I think, where towards the last third of the book, Huck is given an option. He can turn Jim in, which will mean that Jim will be arrested and taken back to his owner's house back up north, where in Missouri, where Huck was from. Or he can not turn Jim in and let Jim stay free, with the possibility that he will be able to be reunited with his wife and his children. Huck's response to this decision is to say, I'm not going to turn Jim in. All right, then, I'll go to hell. Because the way he was brought up was to believe that only a bad person would allow a slave to escape. And Huck had been told he was a bad person all his life. And so on some level, he just felt that he was living up to his birth and decided to do the evil thing and let Jim go. Now, every time I taught this, we'd get to this part and my kids would all go, wah, blah, 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 and I'd always have to say, look, you know, for a kid like Huck, He's not stupid. This kid is really smart and very clever, but he is undereducated and miseducated in a number of ways. So for this kid, the threat of going to hell, this was not metaphoric. This was literal. Completely and utterly literal. When he chooses to save Jim, he chooses to spend eternity in hell, in his mind. Of course, we, because it's satire and it's ironic and it's dramatic irony, we, the audience, are supposed to understand that he is, in fact, doing exactly the opposite for his eternal soul. But not for Huck. Huck doesn't know that. I think it's very important in Hawthorne, because he does do this marvelous job of presenting you with kind of a supernatural or sometimes a spiritual interpretation of happenings, as well as a more scientific or secular interpretation of what's happening. Because he is so careful to do that, it is also important for us to approach the book, whether we are believers or not, or whether we are not just like believers in kind of the Christian paradigm, but also believers in Satan as an actual physical force on the planet or not. It is important for us to be able to get into the mindset of the people who are participating in the story as it's presented by Hawthorne. The people who Hester lives among actually believe that you could go out into the nature, into the woods, and commune with the devil. It is as simple as that. And if you treat them with any less than the respect that that attitude deserves, the book's not gonna carry the weight that it would otherwise. So it's kind of important for you to put yourself in their shoes in that respect. This chapter that we're about to start is called The Leech. It is all about Chillingworth. It is also one of those chapters, we got a lot of them in Tale of Two Cities. We get some of them in this book where the chess pieces are being moved into place. Not a lot happens, but you find out a lot of what has been happening, and you can kind of see Chillingworth setting himself up for what comes next. So a couple of things. One, you're going to hear them use the phrase New Jerusalem. It probably means Boston. I don't think they're talking about Rhode Island yet, but this idea of the city on the hill, a shining city on the hill, that it's a good chance that they were talking about Boston. Elixir of Life, you guys know this kind of stuff. This is, you know, like the... if you read Harry Potter, the first book in the British edition, it's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, because the search for the Philosopher's Stone was an actual thing. Sorcerer's Stone was just invented to make American kids want to read the book. But the Philosopher's Stone, it's actually... I mean, Google it! There's the Philosopher's Stone. It was the thing that you needed to make the Elixir of Life, something that would make you live forever. You're going to hear that. When they talk about Oxford, they are, in fact, talking about Oxford University in England. And this just comes and goes, but I'm going to throw it out for you. Love the footnotes. Sir Thomas Overbury and Dr. Foreman. These are the subjects of an adultery scandal in 1615 in England. Dr. Foreman was charged with trying to poison his adulterous wife and her lover. Overbury was a friend of the lover and was, perhaps, poisoned. So, there you go. I'm looking to make sure... Oh, Nathan the prophet? He's a prophet who condemned King David's adultery. David, of course, had a relationship with Bathsheba that he probably shouldn't have had. So you're going to get more in this chapter. You're going to get more about good and evil. Double meaning of the word leech. Leech as in something that grabs onto you and sucks the life out of you. And leech, the term that was used to describe a doctor who used leeches at the time for bloodletting and other such techniques, which they felt, you know, released the bad blood and all that, which, you know, is not a completely crazy idea. If you think that it's the blood that's sick, you would want to get rid of the sick blood. And of course, since the human body does remake blood, it didn't kill you. And in some cases, I actually remember reading hundreds of years ago that they weren't always wrong, that there are certain things that, you know, forcing your body into overdrive to create more fresh blood is not always such a bad thing. Not that I recommend you go sticking leeches on your wrists or anything like that. I'm sure you guys have all heard, well, some of you younger listeners might not have, but I know that even with people who've had limbs amputated accidentally, like if you were the accident of a lawnmower accident or something like that, and your finger was cut off accidentally or something horrifying like that, that one of the ways that they can get blood flow to start going back and forth between your hand and the reattached digit is to put leeches on the digit, the seam thing, because they're sucking the blood, and so that kind of moves it along into the new or the reattached appendage. This is really gross, isn't it? I'm sorry. So double meaning of the word leech. Moving on. You're going to find out how Chillingworth has manipulated the situation to put him closer to the person he suspects. He just suspects. So the relationship is complicated. You have, on the one hand, Chillingworth, who appears to be really, in many ways, holding all the cards. And then you have Dimmesdale, who, as I've described before, is really this just deer in the headlights kind of guy. Well, of course, we only see this after the drama. So, you know, we don't really know what Dimmesdale was like before we first see him talking from the balcony down at Hester. It's very possible that he was very young and robust, and in fact, you kind of get the idea from the way some people talk about how Dimmesdale has changed. You kind of get the idea that maybe he wasn't always a deer in the headlights, but he sure is now. And not only that, but he's getting sicker. So some people are looking at Chillingworth. Now, we already know that he has kind of a hump. One shoulder is higher than the other. But you're really going to get a lot of that imagery that we've talked about before. Very old-fashioned kind of symbolism that an outward appearance is a symbol for your inward state. We had this with Jekyll and Hyde. We've had this all over the place before. This is another one of those places where Chillingworth specifically will be read. His personality, his soul, will be read by some people based on his physical appearance. You're going to hear a lot of that in this chapter. And it's creepy, in a good way. It's a creepy, creepy chapter. I like it a lot. It sets Chillingworth up very, very, very clearly. And the next week we have, what is it called? We have The Leech this week, and The Leech and His Patient next week, which is kind of the further exploits of Chillingworth and Dimmesdale. So, I think that's all the good stuff. I'm going to let you listen. Hang on. Here we go. Chapter 9, The Scarlet Letter, The Leech.
The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Read by Penelope Jarnick. Chapter 9, The Leech. Under the appellation of Roger Chillingworth, the reader will remember, was hidden another name, which its former wearer had resolved should never be spoken. It has been related how, in the crowd that witnessed Hester Prynne's ignominious exposure, stood a man, elderly, travel-worn, who, just emerging from the perilous wilderness, beheld the woman in whom he hoped to find embodied the warmth and cheerfulness of home, set up as a type of sin before the people. Her matronly fame was trodden under all men's feet. Infamy was babbling around her in the public marketplace. For her kindred, should the tidings ever reach them, and for the companions of her unspotted life, there remained nothing but the contagion of her dishonor, which would not fail to be distributed in strict accordance and proportion with the intimacy and sacredness of their previous relationship. Then why, since the choice was with himself, should the individual whose connection with the fallen woman had been the most intimate and sacred of them all, come forward to vindicate his claim to an inheritance so little desirable? He resolved not to be pilloried beside her on her pedestal of shame. Unknown to all but Hester Prynne, and possessing the lock and key of her silence, he chose to withdraw his name from the roll of mankind, and, as regarded his former ties and interests, to vanish out of life as completely as if he indeed lay at the bottom of the ocean, whither rumor had long ago consigned him. This purpose, once effected, new interests would immediately spring up. And likewise a new purpose, dark, it is true, if not guilty, but of force enough to engage the full strength of his faculties. In pursuance of this resolve, he took up his residence in the Puritan town as Roger Chillingworth, without other introduction than the learning and intelligence of which he possessed more than a common measure. As his studies, at a previous period of his life, had made him extensively acquainted with the medical science of the day, it was as a physician that he presented himself, and as such was cordially received. Skillful men of the medical and chirurgical profession were of rare occurrence in the colony. They seldom, it would appear, partook of the religious zeal that brought other emigrants across the Atlantic. In their researches into the human frame, it may be that the higher and more subtle faculties of such men mere materialized, and that they lost the spiritual view of existence amid the intricacies of that wondrous mechanism, which seemed to involve art enough to comprise all of life within itself. At all events, the health of the good town of Boston, so far as medicine had aught to do with it, had hitherto lain in the guardianship of an aged deacon, an apothecary, whose pity and godly deportment were stronger testimonials in his favor than any that he could have produced in the shape of a diploma. The only surgeon was one who combined the occasional exercise of that noble art with the daily and habitual flourish of a razor. To such a professional body, Roger Chillingworth was a brilliant acquisition. He soon manifested his familiarity with the ponderous and imposing machinery of antique physic, in which every remedy contained a multitude of far-fetched and heterogeneous ingredients, as elaborately compounded as if the proposed result had been the elixir of life. In his Indian captivity, moreover, he had gained much knowledge of the properties of native herbs and roots, nor did he conceal from his patients that these simple medicines, nature's boon to the untutored savage, had quite as large a share of his own confidence as the European pharmacopoeia, which so many learned doctors had spent centuries in elaborating. This learned stranger was exemplary as regarded at least the outward forms of a religious life, and early after his arrival had chosen for his spiritual guide the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale. The young divine, whose scholar-like renown still lived in Oxford, was considered by his more fervent admirers as little less than a heaven-ordained apostle, destined, should he live and labor for the ordinary term of life, to do as great deeds for the now feeble New England Church as the early fathers had achieved for the infancy of the Christian faith. About this period, however, the health of Mr. Dimmesdale had evidently begun to fail. By those best acquainted with his habits, the paleness of the young minister's cheek was accounted for by his too earnest devotion to study, his scrupulous fulfillment of parochial duty, and, more than all, by the fasts and vigils of which he made a frequent practice, in order to keep the grossness of this earthly state from clogging and obscuring his spiritual lamp. Some declared that, if Mr. Dimmesdale were really going to die, it was cause enough that the world was not worthy to be any longer trodden by his feet. He himself, on the other hand, with characteristic humility, avowed his belief that, if Providence should see fit to remove him, it would be because of his own unworthiness to perform its humblest mission here on earth. With all this difference of opinion as to the cause of his decline, there could be no question of the fact. His form grew emaciated. His voice, though still rich and sweet, had a certain melancholy prophecy of decay in it. He was often observed, on any slight alarm or other sudden accident, to put his hand over his heart, with first a flush and then a paleness indicative of pain. Such was the young clergyman's condition, and so imminent the prospect that his dawning light would be extinguished all untimely, when Roger Chillingworth made his advent to the town. His first entry on the scene few people could tell whence, dropping down, as it were, out of the sky, or starting from the nether earth, had an aspect of mystery which was easily heightened to the miraculous. He was now known to be a man of skill. It was observed that he gathered herbs and the blossoms of wild flowers, and dug up roots and plucked off twigs from the forest trees, like one acquainted with hidden virtues in what was valueless to common eyes. He was heard to speak of Sir Kenelm Digby and other famous men, whose scientific attainments were esteemed hardly less than supernatural, as having been his correspondents or associates. Why, with such rank in the learned world, had he come hither? What could he, whose sphere was in great cities, be seeking in the wilderness? In answer to this query, a rumor gained ground, and, however absurd, was entertained by some very sensible people, that heaven had wrought an absolute miracle by transporting an eminent doctor of physic from a German university bodily through the air, and setting him down at the door of Mr. Dimmesdale's study. Individuals of wiser faith, indeed, who knew that heaven promotes its purpose without aiming at the stage effect of what is called miraculous interposition, were inclined to see a providential hand in Roger Chillingworth's so opportune arrival. This idea was countenanced by the strong interest which the physician ever manifested in the young clergyman. He attached himself to him as a parishioner, and sought to win a friendly regard and confidence from his naturally reserved sensibility. He expressed great alarm at his pastor's state of health, but was anxious to attempt the cure, and, if early undertaken, seemed not despondent of a favorable result. The elders, the deacons, the motherly dames, and the young and fair maidens of Mr. Dimmesdale's flock were alike importunate that he should make trial of the physician's frankly offered skill. Mr. Dimmesdale gently repelled their entreaties. "I need no medicine," said he. But how could the young minister say so, when, with every successive Sabbath, his cheek was paler and thinner, and his voice more tremulous than before? When it had now become a constant habit, rather than a casual gesture, to press his hand over his heart? Was he weary of his labors? Did he wish to die? These questions were solemnly propounded to Mr. Dimmesdale by the elder ministers of Boston and the deacons of his church, who, to use their own phrase, dealt with him on the subject of rejecting the aid which Providence so manifestly held out. He listened in silence, and finally promised to confer with the physician. "Were it God's will," said the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale, when, in fulfillment of this pledge, he requested old Roger Chillingworth's professional advice, "I could be well content that my labors and my sorrows and my sins and my pains should shortly end with me, and what is earthly of them be buried in my grave, and the spiritual go with me to my eternal state, rather than that you should put your skill to the proof in my behalf." "Ah," replied Roger Chillingworth, with that quietness which, whether imposed or natural, marked all his deportment, "it is thus that a young clergyman is apt to speak. Youthful men, not having taken a deep root, give up their hold of life so easily, and saintly men who walk with God on earth would fain be away to walk with him on the golden pavements of the New Jerusalem. "Nay," rejoined the young minister, putting his hand to his heart, with a flush of pain flitting over his brow, "were I worthier to walk there, I could be better content to toil here." "Good men ever interpret themselves too meanly," said the physician. In this manner the mysterious old Roger Chillingworth became the medical adviser of the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale. As not only the disease interested the physician, but he was strongly moved to look into the character and qualities of the patient, these two men, so different in age, came gradually to spend much time together. For the sake of the minister's health, and to enable the leech to gather plants with healing balm in them, they took long walks on the seashore, or in the forest, mingling various talk with the plash and murmur of the waves, and the solemn wind anthem again among the treetops. Often, likewise, one was the guest of the other, in his place of study and retirement. There was a fascination for the minister in the company of the man of science, in whom he recognized an intellectual cultivation of no moderate depth or scope, together with a range and freedom of ideas that he would have vainly looked for among the members of his own profession. In truth, he was startled, if not shocked, to find this attribute in the physician. Mr. Dimmesdale was a true priest, a true religionist, with the reverential sentiment largely developed and an order of mind that impelled itself powerfully along the track of a creed and wore its passage continually deeper with the lapse of time. In no state of society would he have been what is called a man of liberal views. It would always be essential to his peace to feel the pressure of a faith about him, supporting while it confined him within its iron framework. Not the less, however, though with a tremulous enjoyment, did he feel the occasional relief of looking at the universe through the medium of another kind of intellect than those with which he habitually held converse. It was as if a window were thrown open, admitting a freer atmosphere into the close and stifled study, where his life was wasting itself away amid lamplight or obstructed daybeams, and the musty fragrance, be it sensual or moral, that exhales from books. But the air was too fresh and chill to be long breathed with comfort, so the minister and the physician with him withdrew again within the limits of what their church defined as orthodox. Thus Roger Chillingworth scrutinized his patient carefully, both as he saw him in his ordinary life, keeping an accustomed pathway in the range of thoughts familiar to him, and as he appeared when thrown amidst other moral scenery, the novelty of which might call out something new to the surface of his character. He deemed it essential, it would seem, to know the man before attempting to do him good. Wherever there is a heart and an intellect, the diseases of the physical frame are tinged with the peculiarities of these. In Arthur Dimmesdale, thought and imagination were so active and sensibility so intense that the bodily infirmity would be likely to have its groundwork there. So, Roger Chillingworth, the man of skill, the kind and friendly physician, strove to go deep into his patient's bosom, delving among his principles, prying into his recollections, and probing everything with a cautious touch, like a treasure seeker in a dark cavern. Few secrets can escape an investigator who has opportunity and license to undertake such a quest, and skill to follow it up. A man burdened with a secret should especially avoid the intimacy of his physician. If the latter possess native sagacity and a nameless something more, let us call it intuition, if he show no intrusive egotism, nor disagreeably prominent characteristics of his own, if he have the power which must be born with him to bring his mind into such affinity with his patients, that this last shall unawares have spoken what he imagines himself only to have thought, if such revelations be received without tumult, and acknowledged not so often by an uttered sympathy as by silence, an inarticulate breath, and here and there a word to indicate that all is understood. If to these qualifications of a confidant be joined the advantages afforded by his recognized character as a physician, then, at some inevitable moment, will the soul of the sufferer be dissolved, and flow forth in a dark but transparent stream, bringing all its mysteries into the daylight. Roger Chillingworth possessed all, or most, of the attributes above enumerated. Nevertheless, time went on. A kind of intimacy, as we have said, grew up between these two cultivated minds, which had as wide a field as the whole sphere of human thought and study to meet upon. They discussed every topic of ethics and religion, of public affairs and private character. They talked much, on both sides, of matters that seemed personal to themselves. And yet, no secret, such as the physician fancied must exist there, ever stole out of the minister's consciousness into his companion's ear. The latter had his suspicions, indeed, that even the nature of Mr. Dimmesdale's bodily disease had never fairly been revealed to him. It was a strange reserve. After a time, at a hint from Roger Chillingworth, the friends of Mr. Dimmesdale effected an arrangement by which the two were lodged in the same house, so that every ebb and flow of the minister's lifetide might pass under the eye of his anxious and attached physician. There was much joy throughout the town when this greatly desirable object was attained. It was held to be the best possible measure for the young clergyman's welfare, unless, indeed, as often urged by such as felt authorized to do so, he had selected some one of the many blooming damsels spiritually devoted to him to become his devoted wife. This latter step, however, there was no present prospect that Arthur Dimmesdale would be prevailed upon to take. He rejected all suggestions of the kind, as if priestly celibacy were one of his articles of church discipline. Doomed by his own choice, therefore, as Mr. Dimmesdale so evidently was, to eat his unsavory morsel always at another's board, and endure the lifelong chill which must be his lot who seeks to warm himself only at another's fireside, it truly seemed that this sagacious, experienced, benevolent old physician, with his concord of paternal and reverential love for the young pastor, was the very man of all mankind to be constantly within reach of his voice. The new abode of the two friends was with a pious widow of good social rank, who dwelt in a house covering pretty nearly the site on which the venerable structure of King's Chapel has since been built. It had the graveyard, originally Isaac Johnson's home field, on one side, and so was well adapted to call up serious reflections suited to their respective employments in both minister and man of physic. The motherly care of the good widow assigned to Mr. Dimmesdale a front apartment with a sunny exposure and heavy window curtains to create a noontide shadow when desirable. The walls were hung round with tapestry, said to be from the Gobelin looms, and at all events representing the scriptural story of David and Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet, in colors still unfaded, but which made the fair woman of the scene almost as grimly picturesque as the woe-denouncing seer. Here the pale clergyman piled up his library, rich with parchment-bound folios of the fathers and the lore of rabbis and monkish erudition, of which the Protestant divines, even while they vilified and decried that class of writers, were yet constrained often to avail themselves. On the other side of the house, old Roger Chillingworth arranged his study and laboratory, not such as a modern man of science would reckon even tolerably complete, but provided with a distilling apparatus and the means of compounding drugs and chemicals, which the practical alchemist knew well how to turn to purpose. With such commodiousness of situation, these two learned persons set themselves down, each in his own domain, yet familiarly passing from one apartment to the other, and bestowing a mutual and not incurious inspection into one another's business. And the Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale's best discerning friends, as we have intimated, very reasonably imagined that the hand of Providence had done all this, for the purpose besought in so many public and domestic and secret prayers of restoring the young minister to health. But, it must now be said, another portion of the community had latterly begun to take its own view of the relationship betwixt Mr. Dimmesdale and the mysterious old physician. When an uninstructed multitude attempts to see with its eyes, it is exceedingly apt to be deceived. When, however, it forms its judgment, as it usually does, on the intuitions of its great and warm heart, the conclusions thus attained are often so profound and so unerring as to possess the character of truths supernaturally revealed. The people, in the case of which we speak, could justify its prejudice against Roger Chillingworth by no fact or argument worthy of serious refutation. There was an aged handicraftsman, it is true, who had been a citizen of London at the period of Sir Thomas Overbury's murder, now some 30 years agone. He testified to having seen the physician under some other name, which the narrator of the story had now forgotten, in company with Dr. Forman, the famous old conjurer who was implicated in the affair of Overbury. Two or three individuals hinted that the man of skill, during his Indian captivity, had enlarged his medical attainments by joining in the incantations of the savage priests, who were universally acknowledged to be powerful enchanters, often performing seemingly miraculous cures by their skill in the black art. A large number, and many of these, were persons of such sober sense and practical observation that their opinions would have been valuable in other matters, affirmed that Roger Chillingworth's aspect had undergone a remarkable change while he had dwelt in town, and especially since his abode with Mr. Dimmesdale. At first, his expression had been calm, meditative, scholar-like. Now, there was something ugly and evil in his face, which they had not previously noticed, and which grew still the more obvious to sight the oftener they looked upon him. According to the vulgar idea, the fire in his laboratory had been brought from the lower regions, and was fed with infernal fuel, and so, as might be expected, his visage was getting sooty with the smoke. To sum up the matter, it grew to be a widely diffused opinion that the Reverend Arthur Dimmesdale, like many other personages of especial sanctity in all ages of the Christian world, was haunted, either by Satan himself, or Satan's emissary, in the guise of old Roger Chillingworth. This diabolical agent had the divine permission, for a season, to burrow into the clergyman's intimacy and plot against his soul. No sensible man, it was confessed, could doubt on which side the victory would turn. The people looked, with an unshaken hope, to see the minister come forth out of the conflict, transfigured with the glory which he would unquestionably win. Meanwhile, nevertheless, it was sad to think of the perchance mortal agony through which he must struggle toward his triumph. Alas, to judge from the gloom and terror in the depths of the poor minister's eyes, the battle was a sore one, and the victory anything but secure. So ends chapter 9.
So it's a battle now, is it? That's just the way things are. I've been listening to a Christopher Moore book called Fool, which is kind of his really vulgar, in many ways, take on King Lear. But it's really, really well read by the guy who's reading it. I can't remember his name. My husband's been getting me audiobooks. Isn't that sweet? Because I have to drive the kids everywhere. So that's his little gift to me. And the guy who reads it has the best accent, and he can do any accent at all. So now his accents are in my head. Alrighty. I just received a Twitter post from Quietish that she's going to see Ben Folds right now in concert, and I am so jealous. And she's going to go, when she hears me say that on the podcast. I hope you all have a great week. I am so excited. I actually managed to do what I promised. I got the last podcast out last Sunday night, and here I am 4 days later, Thursday, getting out the next podcast, just like I said I would. Makes me hope for the future. I hope you have a great week. I am looking forward to a lovely weekend with my boys and my husband and lots of good movies, and go see Star Trek. And while you're at it, go see Night at the Museum, Battle for the Smithsonian. And I think this Saturday we're going to go see Up, which I'm also looking forward to. I hope you have good times in your future as well. And I hope you take care of yourself in this fluish world that we live in right now. Take care. I'll talk to you in a week. Bye. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knitting Out Loud. Listen while you knit. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com, or you can subscribe at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.